Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 5 minutes after 2 p.m., April 4th, 2012. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, and myself, Senator Stedman. We've got two items of labor this afternoon. We're going to start with Senate Bill 203, Energy Assistance Program and Vouchers. Then we're going to have a at ease, and I got to meet with PFC Energy, and then we're going to bring back some updated numerics from this morning that we talked about. So we'll have to keep you posted on how long that at ease will be. But they are on their way over to the building as we speak. I'd like to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 203 by Senator Thomas regarding energy assistance program and vouchers. This is the second hearing on this bill. First time we heard it was the 23rd of February, then March 27th. At the last hearing, we adopted committee substitute version D. The intent today is to bring the bill back for the purpose of adopting another committee substitute and look to the will of the committee. Senator Hoffman, may I have a motion to adopt committee version E, substitute version E?
Mr. Chairman, as a co-sponsor of this bill, it's with enthusiasm I move that we adopt CS for Senate Bill 203/E as our working document.
And I'll object with equal enthusiasm and ask Senator Thomas to explain the bill.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, for hearing this bill again today and then adopting the committee substitute. Senate Bill 203 provides Alaskans with relief from the effects of high 2011 energy costs through distribution of energy vouchers this fall. The voucher program recognizes and addresses the disparate cost of energy depending on the type of fuel and the community in which you live. The bill then directs the governor to evaluate options and make a recommendation for the best energy relief program that can be instituted in fiscal year 14. Last Tuesday, March 27th, the committee adopted CS Work Draft D. You now have before you Work Draft E, which incorporates suggestions made by the Department of Law and AHFC for the purpose of addressing some legal issues or potential legal issues. With the chairman's permission, my aide, Catherine Reardon, will summarize the changes made by the new CS, if that would be appropriate.
Right, yeah, we just want to hear the changes of the CS, please.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Catherine Reardon, and I'm an aide to Senator Thomas. With a single exception, the changes made by the new CS are suggestions made by the Department of Law or AHFC to address legal concerns. The three substantive changes are, one, allowing people who did not apply for the 2012 PFD but would have qualified for that PFD to apply separately for the energy voucher. Many veterans apparently do not apply for the PFD to avoid reductions in their veterans' benefits. This amendment would allow them, as well as others, to receive the voucher. A voucher denial appeal process is also provided in the CS. Two, expanding the hold harmless section to cover reductions in federal supplemental security income, SSI benefits, and food assistance through WIC and the Federal Commodity Supplemental Food Program. This change will result in a fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services. Three, adding 31 million BTU of hot water or steam district heat to the voucher. District heat is piped to houses in a manner similar to natural gas distribution. 31 million British thermal units represents approximately 2 months of district heat for the average residential consumer, which is the focus of the voucher for all of the fuels. There are also four minor, what I would characterize as technical changes. First, changing the word state to the word corporation in two spots on page 2, lines 23 and 29, to clarify that AHFC is the entity responsible for issuing voucher payments to distributors and receiving any unused voucher credit when utility accounts are closed. Next, specifically authorizing the Department of Revenue to share the physical addresses as well as the mailing addresses of PFD applicants with AHFC for the purpose of administering the energy voucher program. That appears on page 7, lines 22 to 23. And inserting the word physical in eight locations where the bill refers to the voucher recipient's primary residence in the state. So we'll say primary physical residence in the state. The purpose of this change is to clarify that the energy provided by the voucher must be used in the place the recipient physically occupies. That appears on four different pages. The final change is replacing the term incompetent with the term incapacitated in subsections J and K, which relate to legal guardians signing vouchers for people who cannot act on their own behalf. Incapacitated is now the more appropriate term. And there's also a definition of incapacitated incorporated into the bill. Thank you.
Okay, with that, I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. Do we have further objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, version D is our working document. Senator Thomas, you want to explain what the bill does, please?
Basically, the bill does allow the opportunity for voucher for energy that can be turned into a dealer. The dealers in the state will have to be verified, registered, dealers that actually deal in natural gas or fuel oil on a regular basis, people that have been in business. And once that established, the permanent fund will create a list that then allows Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to keep track of what exactly takes place as far as the vouchers, and the vouchers will be sent to every head of household living in the state of Alaska, and allows through the compensation or the general levelization of heating fuel and basically natural gas to receive a voucher that they can turn into their supplier. Most of the natural gas obviously is supplied in Anchorage through NSTAR. So that's a relatively simple operation there. And then, of course, fuel oil throughout the state is a little different, but we seem to have managed that problem fairly well with the help and assistance of AHFC as far as how that operation would work. So that's the short story, anyhow, of how it works. Works through the distributors being able to create counts for people, which was makes it a simpler operation as well. And they would then deliver the fuel that is allowed. It allows a maximum of 250 gallons of fuel oil. And those that do not necessarily use fuel oil would be allowed to seek a $250 payment in lieu of using the fuel oil.
And I did misspeak, so I want to correct the record. We're on version E, as in Edward. Okay, thank you, Senator Thomas. We have three fiscal notes in your packet, one fiscal note from the Department of Revenue on behalf of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation with an appropriation request in the amount of $15 million in CIP receipts for FY13 and 10 full-time positions to administer the program. The fiscal note assumes a $465 million appropriation in the FY13 capital budget to pay for the vouchers. One fiscal note from the Department of Revenue on behalf of the Permanent Fund Division for $219,500 in general funds for FY13 and two new temporary positions for the anticipated increases in appeals and additional auditing expenses. And one fiscal note from the Department of Administration, the amount of $113,600 in interagency receipts for the anticipated increase in administrative hearings. We previously had a public hearing. Do committee members have any questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, Senator Hoffman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass CS for Senate Bill 203 Finance from committee to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral. Do we have objection? With individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move the bill from committee to the next committee referral, and we will stand at ease to the call of the chair. come back from our at ease. We're going to pick up with a new presentation, updated slide analysis from PFC Energy. And what this does is, as we work through the system and refined our model, there's glitches from time to time or wrinkles that you have to iron out. Sometimes money's moved one direction, sometimes they'd move the other. But it became apparent that there was an accidental double counting of an expenditure which moved a couple hundred million or so, 150 million net, in the numerics that we were looking at. So I had asked PFC to rework that, come back with an adjusted progressivity numerics, holding revenue constant at $100 in FY13, try to hold it as revenue neutral below $100, and not counting the floor was a 40. So I had discussions following this morning's meeting with them, and I'll have them go into it, but we changed the progressivity trigger to a lower numeric by $5 and lowered the upper leveling area by $5, and then increased the slope by 0.02. It used to be 0.25, now it's 0.27. And I had them round that. It looked like some of the numerics got a little bit closer to revenue neutral at 0.275, but I thought it just, you know, this is not an exact science, so we just took it up 0.27. So with that, I'd like to have PFC go ahead and do the presentation, and that'll allow me to get some feedback from the committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Janik Mayer. I am a manager in the upstream and gas practice of PFC Energy and project manager of this engagement. We are undertaking, contracted by Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, to provide analysis on oil and gas fiscal terms reform issues. One quick slide to start, essentially simply to outline the thresholds of the progressive severance tax on gross under the revised parameters the Chair mentioned. The parameters as adjusted since this morning to get us closer to matching more exactly based on FY13 numbers at the $100 oil mark is progressive severance on gross kicking in at $60 rather than $65 gross value point of production, progressivity of 0.27 commencing at that $60 threshold, rising up until the point at $120 gross value point of production, a tax rate of 16.2% is reached, and at that point a reduction in progressivity down to 0.03% rather than the previous 0.05%. And then again capped to 20%. To look briefly at what that looks like on an updated version of the charts shown earlier this morning, we have, as you can see, very close in terms of revenue from production tax at the $100 mark, starting to diverge slightly around the 120 mark, and then it's shortly after that we see the more significant divergence. Following slides that simply show the same thing, looking at total state take and total government take. And then on slide 5, we have, most crucially, the numbers. So what we're looking at then is, at $100 barrel oil, $3.628 billion production tax under ACES versus $3.577 under 192.
And then the total state take, you want to go over those numbers at 100?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, total state take at $100 a barrel, $7.629 billion under ACES, $7.582 under Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 192.
And then, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Under cash to the companies, what they were looking at the high end, we would be passing back about $1 billion when we're right under $70 a barrel. Is that correct? Between ACES and 192?
Senator Huffman, through the chair, which price deck?
At 100, right below $170, they would be starting to receive over $1 billion, and we would be pushing across the table.
Senator Huffman, through the chair, that is correct.
And then at $200 a barrel, that would increase to $1.7 billion. Is that correct?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, that looks correct to me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
To follow along with that, at $100 a barrel is about a $31 million change, and the cash to companies is where we're calculating it. And as you increment up, 110, it goes to 92, 120, 180, 180 million. And then to the government, we're off about 31 million, which is pretty close, about 5 on at the price of 90, and up 12 on at 80, and down 7 at 70, so it kind of moves around. That's the current tax structure. Turn the mic down a little bit. Current tax structure. And then as you advance north of 100, at 110 to the government would be down 92 million, 120, 180 million, 130, 340 million rounded off. I think as you move further away from where we're currently in the price range, and the longer the prices stay there, expenditures are going to change and these numbers will change. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it would materialize, or if the price went to 200, that expenditures underneath wouldn't advance. So that spread probably wouldn't materialize, but these ones in a range closer to where we're at is probably pretty close as we can get it. And then I had them put on HB 110 again on there, because I know there would be questions about that as in a comparison, just the discussion around the building, so it makes it cleaner to see for everybody. We're still working on, I guess I'll let them go through the rest of the slides, but then I'll... Do we have any questions on that table? We just need to make sure there's not a lot of footnotes on these charts. So we just need to make sure that, you know, that we don't get crossed in our data sheets as we work through this. So everybody, you know, was working off the same data sheets as we change the numerics, the triggers, and the slope a little bit. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following slide, slide 6, simply shows those same numbers adjusted downward by $400 million to account for credits not claimed against current production. Slide 7, I wanted to bring up an issue with the way the tax floor is currently written in the draft CS, which is I think there are two significant issues with specifying any tax floor, irrespective of the question of the level that tax floor is set, in specifying it's simply for large fields only. So in this case, the language in the bill currently is for areas that have produced a billion barrels cumulatively, I think, and 100,000 barrels a day in the current year. It seems to me that there are two problems with this. The biggest is part of everything we've done so far is trying to simplify and get away from the question of having to account for costs for different streams of production separately. And we've managed to do that in the case of the whole question of oil and gas decoupling by taking progressivity out of the net profit tax and doing it on gross instead. Similarly, if a particular minimum floor is to be levied only on particular assets and not on others, it again comes back to that question then of needing to be able to calculate what the costs are directly associated with those particular assets as opposed to any other. And I think we're again getting back to that question of multiple different streams of cost accounting for different assets for different producers. The other issue, which I think is a smaller one, is that the 100,000 barrel a day production threshold has at least the potential to create an undesirable incentive, particularly in the context, for instance, of I notice Kuparuk is probably only, I need to check my revenue sources, but I think around 4-odd years away from reaching that threshold. Given this is a floor that only applies at very low price levels that I think are at least not highly likely in the immediate term future, this is not a particularly significant incentive. But in principle, we're at a larger issue. At some point, there becomes an incentive to get down below that threshold sooner rather than later, which is, I would suggest, not the direction in which we want things to move. Administratively, it seems a much easier approach would be not trying to pursue the asset level distinction, but instead making the distinction at the company level, since all of the taxes are done at the company level anyway. And if the essential aim in the bill is to exempt small producers from this, then in fact to deal with that distinction directly by exempting small producers rather than trying to make the distinction on the asset basis and therefore have to account for costs on the asset basis. There are no questions, Mr. Chair. I'll move on from that point. Okay. With regard to incentives for new production, we've talked about this quite a bit so far, particularly the question of incentivizing production from new areas. We've spoken sort of hypothetically about the possibility of incentivizing new production associated with plans of development and through the regulatory process. I think the more one looks into that, the more difficulties there seem with that approach, and that incentivization of production above a fixed decline rate probably achieves much of the same outcome with greater simplicity. We've talked before about a reduced rate of the progressive tax on gross for new production for some period of time. Again, what's been modelled is one of progressivity of 0.05% commencing at that $60 threshold and capped at 5%. But in the case of the other alternative, which is the question of incremental production from existing producers, existing fields, above some fixed decline rate, that can't have a specific limit in time set in the same way, because if the only question is how far above some notional target rate set on the basis of that decline curve is one, that's a number in the current year, but it's not a particular stream of production that started at a particular time. And so if one wants to have that limit on the reduced rate for the new fields, and one wants, broadly speaking, the two benefits to be closer, at least, to being equal, one way of doing that would be to have some sort of intermediate regime with no time limit on incremental production. an option that's been shown here is essentially halving the progressivity from the standard rate. So progressivity 0.14, commencing at that $60 threshold, reaching a tax rate of 8.4% at 120, again, after that point, being reduced to 0.03% and then being capped at 10%. On the question of how that decline curve is calculated, I showed this particular slide yesterday, but I wanted to put it back up again to reiterate the point of the difference between performing a calculation each year and based on what was production last year and a target being some fraction below that based on a rolling average decline versus setting a fixed point now at this point in time, presumably based on 2011 production figures, and looking back a number of years, taking a company-wide decline rate and simply saying for any given producer, the target, we know now what the target will be next year and the year after that, simply by forecasting that curve forward, and that any production above that target is incentivized, and that way you actually get a meaningful benefit if you do manage to produce above the target in a way that you don't if the calculation is being redone every single year. And in terms of what that decline rate is, I think that, for instance, some of the language we've seen so far already, Senator Wagner in Senate Resources put forward a bill sometimes referred to as the cube root square root method for the particular approach taken in that sense to calculating a decline rate. One can still take that methodology, for instance, but applying it not each 3 years on a rolling basis, but simply now in 2011, looking back to 2009, calculating a decline on that basis, but rather than rolling it and constantly varying it and doing it on each year's production, extending it forward. And finally, updating the total government take comparison from this morning with the revised figures for committee substitute for Senate Bill 192 in terms of the overall rate for mature production. That is shown in the darkest of the yellow or gold lines on this slide. The brighter and somewhat lighter yellow line immediately below that is what that would look like with that halfway line of the incremental 10% capped maximum progressivity that, for instance, could apply to production above that decline curve. And then for new production solely for 7 years, and this is all, of course, on FY 2013 numbers, only. So the impact of the fact that it's only for 7 years isn't captured here. It's just looking at, in a given year, what's the level of government take. The lightest yellow solid line is what it looks like at that 5% level. And then Senator McGuire, through the chair, in response to your questions from this morning, I've included two dashed lines below that, the lowest being what it looks like with no progressivity whatsoever, and above that being what it looks like with a 2% maximum on progressivity.
Do you have any questions? We're still working on the language for incremental production. When we have that ready, I don't know. Ledge Legal's working their little hearts out over there on it, and we spent, why the meeting was delayed so long today, we were huddled up in my office going over the mechanical concepts and the mechanics of the statutes, not so much working on the numerics, but just how to make it work within within the structure that we have without minimizing the disruptions or the need for Ledge Legal to rewrite statutes for days because they're so interwound. So that's why the meeting was delayed. We have Senator Ellison and Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I received from another majority senator a some questions here for me to pose, if you'll allow. And these are his words. The revenue comparisons on page 4 of this morning's presentation assume a certain amount of oil production. So that was page 4 that looked like this from this morning. The oil production numbers come from the revenue source book. That's correct, I'm sure. FY13 forecast is for 550,000 barrels per day. Fall source book, page 31. So the question is, would any of that 555,000 be counted as new oil under this, the concept that we're moving toward? And if yes, please identify which sources would be new using page 101 of the source book. And if yes, again, do the revenue comparisons on page 4 of this morning's presentation take that into account?
Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Ellis, through the chair, the revenue comparisons are certainly done on the basis solely of the maximum rate applying to everything. One issue we are looking at the moment as we figure out how the question of that, for instance, that decline curve would work, how it would be calculated, is also the question of, for new production, completely new production from new areas that have started in recent years, for instance, that doesn't have 3 years of historical production on which to base a decline and doesn't have declining production, how should that be treated? One option, for example, would be to simply include those in the new production components, since it is, after all, only a question of a couple of years of when they started, and those are also, by and large, high-cost projects that one might want to provide some relief for, particularly since high-cost projects can actually face a more significant tax burden at current prices under the gross option. If that were to be the case, then there is probably an adjustment to make in the revenue figure to account for that. I need to have a look at what that would be.
Thank you.
And the amount of, or the significance of the adjustment would be fairly minor, I would think, because of the volumes coming out of Prudhoe Park, roughly 450,000 barrels out of the 600, just the sheer weight of them. But it would be probably a numeric change, and we're struggling with a couple of the areas and how we do this incremental. And that's a policy call, the incremental production out of the legacy fields. It was suggested by Prudhoe or by Pedro and PFC that we address that. We don't necessarily have to if we don't want to. But I think, in my opinion, we need to address some kind of incentive for incremental production above the decline curve in our legacy fields. Mm-hmm. But we're working with, and one of the other things I haven't asked them to do, is when we decide to go ahead and use that algorithm, the committee is going to want to look at the projection, especially if it's stuck in, if we use 2009, 2010, and 2011 as our base and project out from there, how does that look compared to what we've been shown in 2012 and 2013? Where does that mathematical line come to the projections that the committee has looked at? So there's some of that stuff to be worked out. Incremental production cap at 10%, your fourth column over on page 10, page is up there, right there. It's basically a reduction in the progressivity to 0.14. I just took the 0.27 and cut it in half. So there wasn't a lot of rocket science in it, but we've talked about the magnitude of going from zero to nothing. So that's a numeric that the committee will have to set. We need something on the table for the people to have a good feel for. And it could be anywhere from no incremental incentive to you know, zero progressivity on it, which I think would be going way too far, personally. And everybody will have their own opinion. And I just want to have some input from the committee members. So if you want them, and it's a linear relationship, but if you want to have different, you know, different progressivity slope, you know, if we're using a 0.14 for incremental production, if you want to see, you know, we're starting at a base progressivity of 0.27. So if you want to see some other increment, three quarters of it or two thirds of it, we can run that. Clearly, we've got some here that go down to zero. So zero, you're just with your base rate of 25. We have any other, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mayor, as we look at the last page 10 there, it talks about the new production incentives. What's all included in that new production incentives besides the tax credit?
Senator Olson, I'm not sure I've understood the question, I'm sorry.
On the top of page 10 where it says including new production incentives, what's all included in that list?
This is simply looking at, and my apologies, Senator, the word included may be misleading in that sense. It's simply looking at different lower rates of taxation for new production and their impact on government take.
So it doesn't include the tax credit?
In as far as it's modeling the full system, it includes the 20% capital credit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think the only variable that's changing is the progressivity.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we're ratcheting that down. And again, it's a linear relationship, so we can dial it up or dial it down, just like we did here today when we were, you know, we had that glitch where we had to dial it up from 0.25 to 0.27 to zero in. So it's not difficult for PFC to run a different numeric if any of the committee members want a different one run, or you can just extrapolate it and probably get it just as close with the data that's in front of you. Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Just a couple questions. The first, Janet, thank you for your slide 10. As between new production with a 2% max on progressivity or new production with no progressivity, which is easier to administer, or is there a difference?
Can you repeat the last part of the question?
Sorry, which is easier to administer? We talked earlier today about how lowering the base rate would make it very difficult to administer. As between these two, is it indistinguishable?
Senator McGuire, through the chair, largely indistinguishable. Taking away the progressive element entirely takes one element of the tax out, and to the extent that that's simpler, that's slightly simpler, but it's the progressive tax only requires production volume and price to calculate, so it's not a highly administratively complex thing to calculate.
Okay, and then my second question is, in previous testimony, you have provided slides where you've run cash flows that show government take and industry take at different ranges, 200,000 barrels per day fields and 10,000 barrels per day fields, and I'd like to see those at some point. I don't want to take up too much time, but just to be able to see how that runs. And then finally, my last two, I don't want us to get into a situation that is a little bit like what we did when we adopted ACEs with progressivity at the 0.4 factor and didn't look at how punitive it became at the high end. I don't want to get into that similar situation at the low end. And when I look at $40 oil a day, in particular, barrel per day, those are really high rates of taxation. And I know it's because we have that floor in there. And I just want us to think a little bit. I can't remember the year, but we had oil at $147 a barrel in August of 2008, and either it was the next August, 2009, or 2010, I just can't remember that, where it dropped to 37 a barrel and then went back up to 42 for a period of time. In other words, you know, a lot of what's happening right now in the futures market is speculation about removing reserves from strategic oil reserves, and both internationally and domestically, and how that can impact commodities prices. And so I just want us to make sure that if we're going to come up with a system, that it works at all prices. So I'd just like some thoughts on that. And then the last point is, at some point, some overarching perspective about jurisdictions that have adopted a progressivity element and how they keep it as an incentive and not a detriment. Because I think that, as I discussed in some of our first hearings, there's a fairness element to it, a little bit like progressivity that's built into the IRS system. Some people feel like the more I work, the harder I innovate, the more taxes I pay, and I'm penalized. I'm okay with trying to reduce the progressivity level on new production and find a sweet spot, but I'd like to kind of hear more of that insight that you have, having looked at all these tax models to see how we can change behavior. I thought it was excellent when you went into Alberta and you were able to really definitively say, you and your partner, this is what happened. I was there and I witnessed it and talked to the policymakers, and industry picked up and went to BC and went to Saskatchewan. So whatever we do, we're tweaking numbers here at the finance table, but the goal we can't forget at 35,000 feet is to change behavior. And so I'd just like a little bit more perspective on where you think that spot is with respect to new production and progressivity rates.
Senator McGuire, through the chair. On the first question of high rates at low prices, there are two points to make. One, that some part of the high rates that you see there is indeed the impact of the floor, but the general sloping upward of the curve is also in part simply due to the regressive nature of the regime at low prices, and that's almost entirely a function of the 12.5% fixed royalty that's in there. With any fixed royalty, there comes a price level at which the royalty can, by itself, without any other element in the tax structure, consume almost all the divisible income. And so you have those very high rates of government take. That said, it's certainly true that for existing producers, the proposed floor does raise that higher still, and its impact in that sense is at the point where government take is highest because of the regressive element of the regime, and that's certainly something to take into account. On the question of progressivity and incentives for new development, as we've talked about further in the past, in general, there are two purposes to progressivity. One is to ensure that, compared to sort of regimes that we saw in the past, the sort of standard fixed royalty, where as prices go further and further up, as profit increases, government take steadily decreases, and in so many countries that started with such a system saw eventually some form of rewriting of the fiscal terms, and that's a significant sovereign risk that comes with a completely flat and completely regressive regime, where at some point lawmakers simply say, well, I don't think we can do this anymore, and we'll tear up the current terms and write some new ones. So part of the idea of progressivity is trying to avoid that situation, to create a system that works at a wide range of prices so that one can have stability. In that sense, part of the aim, particularly of having a system that may be progressive on price, can simply to have something that is overall neutral rather than regressive in terms of levels of government take that are relatively stable throughout the system. And so, for instance, the progressivity that's levied on the gross that we're seeing here, that sort of tail 0.05 progressivity that stays after the point at which one has said sort of we're trying to fix the split between government and producers. The aim of that is simply to counteract, for instance, the regressive effect of the royalty at that rate and keep an overall neutral regime from that point onward. Then there is progressivity that's introduced to try to get government an increasing slice of the take at higher levels. In some circumstances, that can be useful if it means that there is an overall fiscal target that needs to be met, but one needs to make sure that there is still workable economics at lower prices for companies that can help meet that fiscal target. But one needs to be careful that what one is creating isn't a situation where, and I think we've seen this under ACEs, where progressivity is so great that there is incrementally less and less benefit to any additional dollar in oil price for companies. And in that sense, yeah, I think this comes back to that question of efficiency versus competitiveness. One can design quite a economically efficient regime in as far as it's one that's not taxing basic returns on capital, ideally, but one that is seeking to tax excess super profits or economic rents, and high levels of progressivity can be quite compatible with that. But that doesn't necessarily make such a regime particularly competitive in a broader context, particularly in a broader context at the moment where there is a huge amount of investment dollars going into the lower 48 in regimes with much lower, not only much lower levels of government take, but also lower levels of cost and therefore better economics. So it's important to look at both and to keep in mind that question of competitiveness in designing a fiscal regime.
Other questions, Mr. Mayor? Senator Hawkins.
Thank you. I guess I'd like to comment upon the floor versus the giving the amount that we're giving up at the high end versus the assurance at the low end. You know, I think that Janik said that the probability of price being at the low end are not very high, but when you look at the amount that we're seeing at $325 million increase at $40 a barrel, I mean, or the cash to the companies at $194 million at $40 a barrel, that's the increase taxes that they would have to pay. And then you look at the gains that they would get at the high end. You know, you look at $120 a barrel, they would gain $180. So after that, or $120, they would be getting $180. But as I mentioned earlier, when you approach $170, they're going to get $1 billion. And at $200, they're getting additional $1.7 billion. So I think you have to look at it from my viewpoint, that the trade-offs that we're giving up at the high end and the insurances that we're getting at the low end, and we still have to take into consideration what we're giving up and the probability of what it may be at $40 a barrel.
Fair point.
Other questions for Mr. Janik today? Well, thanks for coming in this afternoon and helping us with this. We'll be working on the bill and incremental production and having conversations amongst ourselves to try to set some of these rates and get a bill out on the table. So we'll see everybody tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. Meeting adjourned.